Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In a world where we are constantly bombarded with text and pictures and rapid-fire information, what do we gain when we choose to pay close attention? My guest today advocates cutting through the visual clutter by learning new ways to see. And what could be better to focus our distracted brains than great works of art? Camille Paglia is University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Her latest book is called Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. Camille, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You make the point, and it's such a sad one, that art today makes headlines only when it is stolen or fetches a record price at auction. What does that say about the diminishment of the role that art plays in public discourse?
Well, I think in the U.S., certainly, mass media have totally overwhelmed the fine arts. And I sketch out in my introduction to Glittering Images how art has always struggled for recognition in the U.S., where we are a practical, commercial culture, and we were removed because of the Atlantic Ocean from the radical changes in style that were going on throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries in Europe. So one of the reasons I wrote this book was my sense, as a longtime listener to talk radio, of how the mainstream audience in the U.S. really still has not fully accepted, for example, abstract art, which is now a century old. So I'm trying to reach in the book people who have had no contact at all with art. It's a very slim book that you can just hold in your hand. It contains the whole history of art in very short chapters. But I'm also trying to communicate with the art world. I've been teaching in art schools for 40 years. My sense of the kind of ironies and the nihilism of the art world, the commercially inflated rhetoric, and the image conscious and over trendy galleries. And so on. I'm trying to argue that the greatest art always has a spiritual dimension, a spiritual message. It ultimately is a form of religious thinking.
And in ironically, in some ways, that connection of art to religious thinking, particularly in a very traditional sense in older works, has played into the fact that we don't teach a lot of art history in public schools.
Right. This is one of the things I'm trying to put on the table here. In Europe, the fine arts tradition is part of their history. Therefore, it's taught in grade school, and people are surrounded by art everywhere, which can be a disadvantage, as the sense, oppressive sense of the great past. I think it can stifle, actually, originality and creativity, ultimately. But in the U.S., what is called art class is this do-it-yourself thing where students are handed construction paper and a glue pot and told to find their inner artist. Well, this produces Philistines. I mean, our students know nothing about the history of the fine arts. And in college, the once venerable big lecture hall type art history course, the survey that goes from cave art to modernism, these are slowly being abandoned because the kind of graduate training that's going on encourages students to focus on a particular area and to use highfalutin theory and to show how advanced you are, et cetera, et cetera. So these wonderful courses that gave a sense of history, the evolution of time, and how, and also the wonderful cascading influences over many centuries in millennia and so on, that experience is being lost. There's nothing to encourage young people to take an art history course, and even if they do, I can't promise that they're going to have a positive experience in this theory-mad climate where students are encouraged to criticize art, to look for its flaws, its racism, sexism, homophobia, instead of appreciating it. I come from an Italian-American culture that honors art, that admires the art. I have a kind of celebratory attitude toward it that I hope will encourage other teachers and grad students to take that tone also with students.
So, Camille, to the extent that the art community at times seems more engaged in engaging fellow artists than the general public, is that more than just a vicious cycle of mutual disdain? So, you know, you have, like, talk radio saying art is pointless and it's not worth anything, and then the art community then sort of turns in on itself to proliferate?
Yeah, exactly. This is a problem because the art market is now such a major international industry. It was created by Lee Krasner, the artist wife of Jackson Pollock, after he was killed in an auto crash in the late 1950s. And before that, you couldn't get high prices for contemporary art. And now, because actually of the great success of the pop artists who inherited, the new chic that surrounded contemporary art. There's astronomical fortunes that can be made in art, and that in turn spawn galleries which depend on inflating their rhetoric in order to maximize their prices. And you have people who are speculating in the art market internationally who are simply financiers. So these like staggeringly high prices that are obviously ridiculous and specious. So the art world has its own commercial motivation to give the impression that somehow important art is being made. What I argue in Glittering Images is that the avant-garde is dead, and that no really important art has been made since the last thing that I think was genuinely avant-garde were Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs of the sadomasochistic gay underworld. I think that those were truly radical at the time, and they're much imitated now. But that was in the 1970s. I don't see anything important happening in the arts anywhere in the world. I mean, instead, younger people are moving entirely into social media and into other forms. Now, video games are booming, and digital art is booming, although web design I still think is very poor. That's why I end my book with Star Wars. I didn't intend that, okay, but in the process of doing the book, as I searched for something strong in the contemporary arts to end my book with, it begins in Egypt, okay, I couldn't find anything, and instead I find myself being deeply moved by Revenge of the Sith, the great climax on the volcano planet at the end, and I suddenly began to dawn on me, good Lord, George Lucas is the artist who has had the greatest impact worldwide and who has really been an artistic pioneer. So that's how I end my book.
So talk a little bit more about that, because this has been the most discussed, you know, anyone who talks or writes about this book talks about that and is sort of shocked by this. But you have what seems to me to be a pretty reasonable defense of George Lucas.
Yeah, it's like grand opera. The climax at the end, and the great duel on this lava flow on the volcano planet of Mustafar. I mean, if you know the characters of the great saga, you know, Star Wars, it is deeply passionate. It engages the emotions, but also the visuals are absolutely spectacular. And so I've seen it again and again and again, and every time I feel that, you know, this is our Puccini, you know, this is American grand opera. And Lucas is much disdained right now by most critics because they think of him as simply a purveyor of children's literature, children's toys. He's far too rich, he's reclusive, et cetera, et cetera. But there's absolutely no doubt that when you look back at the last 40 years, okay, really since Warhol, I mean, who has had the greatest artistic impact, who has reached millions of people, adults also, and changed their lives and changed their, you know, transformed their imaginations? It's Lucas.
So why do you think other people are unwilling to look at Lucas in that way, or even consider that filmmakers working today in sort of big market films are worthy of this kind of consideration?
Well, unfortunately, we're at a time of these huge blockbusters coming out of Hollywood. The corporate structure of Hollywood has determined that the greatest profits are to be had in these gigantic extravaganzas with a lot of noise and computerized effects and so on, because they can reach an incredible international market. And so there's unfortunately a diminution of the older, lower budget, character-driven storylines that we saw even in the 1980s. So the adults feel increasingly alienated from the kind of fare that young people love going to go to the theater. So I think that there's that sense. Oh, this is Lucas and Steven Spielberg are responsible for this, which is true. Okay, they are the ones whose films did change what seemed to be a film renaissance. I mean, that's what I thought in college and graduate school, with all those wonderful European art films coming over that were made very low budget, but that were filled with metaphysical and philosophical insights, like Ingmar Bergman's Persona, which is like the greatest, one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century. I named my book Sexual Personae after that film, and it is just an incredible work of art and produced with no budget. I think maybe he bought two straw hats and a hospital bed, that was it. Okay, it was just the even use the set of somebody's summer house. And so then we thought that finally film was going to become one of the great fine arts. And then boom, came along Lucas and Spielberg, and they turned the whole audience toward gore and children's stories and so on. So I think there's a lot of animus, against that kind of filmmaking because of that.
So we've sort of leapfrogged over your entire book here, but let's go back to the beginning. Your first selection is the image of Queen Nefertari and the goddess Isis from Nefertari's tomb. And it appears very stylized to modernize, and yet it invites a really careful contemplation of its meaning and then its relevance to Egyptian culture of the time.
Yes, so what I'm trying to encourage in the reader is the ability to sit still in front of an image and to allow the eye to rove in it and to discover interesting details. So we have this image that's obviously a religious image of the queen being led by Isis into the afterworld, but it had all kinds of little tiny details which it took me a very long time to try to run down the meaning of all of them. All this information is kind of scattered, and I tried to reduce it to just a few pages and then an easy lucid read. So I try to do that with each one of the chapters in the book, to try to show how in this period when we turn the computer on and there's these flashing images coming at us, so chaotic, ads and this and that, and everything is truncated, the email form, chop, 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 and to sit and realize how you can go into a kind of trance, a wonderful, calming feeling when the eye is focused. The eye is focused, and then the eye moves around, seeing the details, and then seeing the image as a whole. So I say, that I modeled the book on a missal, a Catholic breviary, right. the collection of images of saints. I'm a collector of those images in religious stores, even though I'm an atheist. But I love those images of the various saints holding whatever, some emblematic sign, sometimes which signifies their martyrdom.
My guest is Camille Paglia. She is University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts. Her new book is called Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Camille Paglia. She is University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia and author of the book Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. If you'd like to join us, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Camille, whenever we look at a work of art, particularly one that has been made before our own time, before contemporary time, we have to consider both the context in which it was made and then the context it takes on in the present moment. Can you talk about some ways that you would suggest to people who don't or haven't regularly engaged with art before about sort of how to get to that place and begin doing that?
Well, I do believe absolutely in the historical situating of every artwork. At the same time, the really great artwork seem to leave their own time and speak with intimacy to people who live hundreds of years or even thousands of years away. And in this, I have to say, I depart from the current orthodoxies in elite academe, which deny that history exists, that there is any narrative at all in history, there's any connectedness to history, any important work of art has simply been declared to be important by a self-interested, a group, a power group that has its own agenda going on. There is no meaning to the artwork except that of its material status, what it's worth economically, and so on. And I think this is a very, very cynical, cheap, and destructive way to present art as it's been done. And the end result is that we have several generations now of young people with very good degrees who don't know how to appreciate at art or how to approach it. But I do believe there is that the artwork has a kind of dual quality. My original aspiration as a child was to be an archaeologist, so I always have that archaeological mentality, always trying to define exactly what this work meant in its own time. And then I go on, each one of my chapters in Glittering Images then ends where I sort of take off and give my own rather ecstatic, a view of the meanings that I find in it myself, from this perspective. Now, what I do believe that everything takes study. And that, but the web is this wonderful resource and just instantaneous. If you just want to get a sense of the bare facts of an artist's life and time, you just go right to the web and it's at your fingertips. I believe that parents have an obligation to expose their children to fine arts in some way. I think that there should be at least one art book in every the well-educated home. My own parents, who had no money. My father was in college at the time I was born. They were only 21. He was part of the returning from World War II. I'm a classic baby boomer. But they subscribed to Book of the Month Club and had this book by Gombrich. Okay, that was called The History of Art. That was just very kind of fuzzy black and white pictures. But that, to have the entire history of art in one book, was to me like absolutely magical, and it had a tremendous impact on me from my earliest years. So I've tried to produce a similar book, and this time with gorgeous full-page color, beautifully done by Knopf and Doubleday. So each image is very ravishing. So in our visual age, I would think, okay, that just paging through and looking at images, drinking them in, okay, is almost sufficient. You almost don't have to read the text. I do believe, as a teacher, career teacher, I do believe in exposure as benevolent. Okay, I believe in history presenting a timeline. Okay, at the same time, I think that the more you can just show to kids. So at any age, including, you know, from grade school to college, the more you show them, the more sort of these images enter into their unconscious and work on them. Each generation will have a different relationship, obviously, a different reaction to all great works. I would never try to impose the reading of my generation on that of younger people. But the real tragedy is when young people have no access whatever to this enormous compendium of images, all of which is available just at the flick of the keyboard.
Hmm. Well, I really liked your explanation. You include a Bronze Age idol found in the Cyclades Islands, and it's very simple. And you write that, you know, in where you're sort of interpreting it, its embodiment of a universal archetype is such a stark contrast to what you call the neurotic individualism of Victorian Europe. And it's interesting to think about their response in that time to a work that is, you know, 4,000 years old and so very simple and beautiful.
Yeah, when people first saw even a Native American art, when the settlers first came here in the 17th century, there was no understanding of the kind of visual vocabulary that was being used by what would later be called primitive art. We no longer use that term, of course. I mean, primitive once meant just the first primary, you know, period and so on. What allowed us to understand that particular image that you mentioned from the Cyclades is so elegant, so streamlined, is that so many modernist artists were excited by that kind of minimalist style. I mean, after the period of Victorian clutter, where, you know, Victorian interior decor was, you know, more is more, and there were like heavy velvet draperies and upholsteries. Mm. Every single surface was covered with bric-a-brac or doilies or whatever. Looking at photographs, you feel suffocated, you know, by it. Picasso was attracted to African and Polynesian tribal art that he saw and influenced. So the birth of modern abstraction, modernism, was inextricable from the discoveries made by archaeology and anthropology in the late 19th century.
Hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Henry in Dallas. Hello, Henry.
Hi. I'm so happy to hear about your dependence on the archaeological.
Okay.
It leads to my question of why consider the most important art to be spiritual instead of considering it to be archetypal.
Oh, the sense of archetype I have very strongly. I am quite influenced by Jung, Carl Jung, who has been completely swept off the table, okay, in the last few decades in academe. I'm an atheist, okay, but I absolutely approach the imagery of world culture from an archetypal dimension. That's actually one of the big themes in my first book, Sexual Personae, where I make all kinds of archetypes about sexual expression, and particularly androgyny. So what I'm saying, however, is that we're at a period when the supposedly most sophisticated minds in academe and the art world are anti-religion. Okay, there's a lot of sneering at religion that I find completely repulsive. Right? And again, I'm speaking as an atheist. Right? The spiritual quest pattern of my baby boom generation has been completely forgotten, and I'm trying to bring that back. That's why so many of my fellow students in the 60s were taking drugs and mushrooms and LSD and basically rotted their brains, unfortunately, and didn't allow them to write the books that they should have. Mm-hmm. But I feel that all of art has this central theme of spiritual quest. So I think that the surprise in the book is that where I show, for example, that Mondrian, you know, the great abstract painter, was in fact totally motivated by spiritual ideals, and every single line, every single rectangle in his work had a spiritual meaning to him. It's all in his journals, but that has been suppressed by the by an art world, okay, that has become very nihilistic and very cheap in its jeers, okay, at religion. This is a mission of my life. Okay, I want to recover for the contemporary students the dignity and the majesty of religious thinking. I mean, my good Lord, post-structuralism is nothing compared to any of the great world religions, which have a metaphysical dimension, which show the relationship between humanity and the universe.
And, of course, there is nothing to say that religious art needs to be safe or comfortable. Can you talk a little bit about, you included Donatello's Mary Magdalene in this book, and it's really a fascinating, disturbing work. Tell us a little bit about what the sculpture looks like and what it represents.
It's absolutely frightening, this wooden sculpture, which appears to be the last work that Donatello did. He's one of the great Renaissance masters, and his early work, he was doing stone, but he has these most beautiful images of bronze images, one of which I featured in my first book, Sexual Personae, which is that of the young David, it's so pedophiliac, okay, in its evocation of the beauty of this 12-year-old boy, that I think Donatello's studio would be raided today. I think he would be in prison, okay, for that work. That is disturbing on ethical grounds. But this last work, he returns to Florence after an exile of some decade and does this strange, haggard wood sculpture of the repentant Mary Magdalene, emaciated, trying to atone for her early sexual sins. And the first time, whenever I would show this image in class for decades, the class gasps, okay,
yeah.
Because it looks so ghoulish. It looks like an apparition from a horror film, okay? This is a woman who is, like, desperate for forgiveness from God, and everything about her, you know, barely looks female. It looks like she's lost all of the fat. You see the muscles, the hair, shirt, and so on. It's just amazing tactile work. Just the surface of it. I wanted to show to reproduce 10 different angles of it, in the book, but that would have been impossible. And it's quite large. It's like 6 feet tall. So it's an intimidating presence in person. So I juxtapose that work, okay, which contains so much almost medieval kind of mortification of the flesh, with Titian's glorification, okay, of a beautiful, plump and opulent Venus, okay, in a boudoir with all kinds of this beautiful surfaces of velvets and everything just to allure and seduce the senses. So that's another thing I tried to do in the book, is to make interesting juxtapositions. Opposites next to each other.
It is fascinating because you sort of turn the page after looking at this very gaunt, disturbing figure of Mary Magdalene, which looks, as you say, like a man in many ways.
Yeah.
And then there's this beautiful woman with cherubs surrounding her. It's an interesting way to sort of remind people of the scope of things and the number of works that exist to be explored. Can you talk about choosing just 29 works? I suppose in some ways it must be liberating because you're not even trying to create a canon here.
Oh, it was very difficult. Well, fortunately, in Sexual Personae, my first book, I had already dealt with Michelangelo and Botticelli and Leonardo, and other of my favorite artists. So I felt freer, okay, in this book, to make a selection. Well, I tried to have images that represented a variety of different styles. Now, it's hard to believe, but study of style in art is completely vanished off the academic landscape. The style studies were quite big when I was in college in the 1960s and grad school into the early 70s. But post-structuralism, with its political ideology reducing everything, okay, to economics and class warfare and so on, it just swept all consideration of aesthetics out the window. So I invented a course at the University of the Arts called Style in Art, which I thought would be excellent to bring together all of my different majors from different fields that I have. I have dancers and jazz musicians and actors and visual artists and so on. And so that everyone could be thinking about style in terms of their own disciplines. And when I looked for a book that about style that I could provide for the course, it wasn't there. So that actually there's nothing, absolutely nothing for 40 years. So I realized I would have to write that book, right? Which I've done. Glittering Images is although it focuses only upon Western art, there's no other way to deal with it and still remain a short book, it tries to show this kaleidoscopic change in style. From ancient Egypt on, so style is to me a very important element, okay, in artistic expression, okay, and it is shocking that academe has so completely abandoned it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Sam in Plano. Hi, Sam.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Earlier in the show, our guest today made a really interesting note about how video games are exploding in popularity, although they are, in a way, devaluing the idea of art as a whole because they are the primary entertainment medium of our youth. I want to know what our guest thought of video games such as the sexuality explorations in games like Persona, the classic opera told in the game Dark Souls, or the deconstruction of how interaction and video games affect culture and the art world as a whole in games like Hotline Miami, and what they mean for art as a whole in an interactive medium.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not much of an expert in video games because I dislike that, you know, the visual world, okay, you know, of games. So it doesn't belong to my generation. However, all of my students are absolutely immersed, okay, in video games. That is their culture in a way that has not yet made an impact on criticism on scholarship, I think, about contemporary culture. Every semester I get, no matter what course I do, I get term projects in video games. I have, in fact, video game designers as my students. It's a major at my particular school. The minds of the video game artists, okay, are very free, okay, much freer than the supposed intellectuals of academe who are so deep into post-structuralism. And I was noticing this actually even slightly earlier in the 1970s and 80s and among cartoonists, okay? Mm. The cartoonist and the video game designer, they both have very, very free and flexible and wide-ranging minds. Now, I do believe that video games are determining the whole future of culture, which is, but it's a dynamic, obviously, form, a kinetic form, right? and we need to develop interest in the static image as well.
My guest is Camille Paglia, University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Her newest book is called Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Camille Paglia, who is University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia and author of the book Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Given the scope of this book, Camille, it seems perfectly appropriate that you have Picasso's Les Demoiselles d'Avignon in here, and you say that it essentially embodies a procession of styles, this one painting, a procession of styles in Western art from antiquity through the Renaissance to modernity. Can you talk about that?
Well, in teaching this work in my classroom over time, I just became aware that even though it's over 100 years old now, I mean, going all the way back to 1907, it really has not been absorbed yet, okay, into most people's minds, especially in the United States, where so many mainstream people think of abstract art as a hoax and of the you know, the artist as a con man. And the you would think that this work, which is really the most important work probably in 20th century art, it represented a revolution in style. You would think that there would be the copious interpretation of it, right? And I was amazed when I actually went to the literature when I was doing the chapter on Picasso for this book, at how many details in the painting have been missed by art critics who were focused on simply formal elements in it. Okay, the radicalism, the way that space is compressed, and there are multiple points of view, and you see the women from standing up, but you also somehow are on the ceiling looking at them lying down, and so on. The use of tribal masks and the archetypal imagery has certainly been noted, and so on. But I think there's been a loss in interpretation of ability to interpret smaller details in the work. So yes, that's one of my theories about that painting, one of a variety of new things that are in that chapter. I say that what we're seeing is Picasso recapitulating the whole history of art and essentially declaring himself, okay, the inheritor of it, because the eyes of these prostitutes, in the waiting room of this brothel, the eyes are on him rather frighteningly. I mean, it does not look like a hospitable environment. It's the place where men come and choose a woman to go upstairs with, but they look like they're going to castrate any male visitor, and you actually can see that, see the kind of knife-like fruit on the table in front of you, and so on. And this work is just absolutely, a masterpiece. But mainstream citizens, okay, who have made no study of art and are skeptical about modernist art, will not have any way, of entering that world. So I've tried to provide it here, just in a few pages, just very welcoming pages to try to explain what the meaning is of this rather horrifying icon.
We have an email here from Dan who writes, does art have to make money to be considered legitimate? Because it seems to me that graffiti and street art have a rich 40-year history that's been growing and breaking new ground every 5 to 10 years, culminating in the most recent examples of Shepard Fairey doing posters for presidential campaigns and questioning the ownership of images to Banksy's public work, elevating the price to property he, quote, vandalizes. Why are these examples and others like it not considered important in the art world?
Oh, they are. Good heavens. Graffiti has produced a great number of testimonials going back decades now. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Certainly in my classes at the University of the Art, my visual arts majors love Banksy, love street art. It's always a project being presented in my classes. But I think that from the outside of the art world, however, I think, again, the mainstream citizen would question the overestimation of graffiti within the art world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Mark in Westboro. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. Enjoy your program. The topic is so interesting. I have a question for the author. How do you view the role of museums and institutions in the visual arts and their seeming inability to get a new generation of patrons and museum attendees? I mean, attendance is at an all-time historic low in America in art museums. And what, if anything, can be done to turn that around?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Camille?
Well, you know, one of the issues is that, you know, museums have turned to the blockbuster mentality of Hollywood, okay, to bring people in. So you do get tremendously well-attended shows, okay, but they tend to be these huge, glitzy productions with a lot of commercial tie-ins in the museum shop. And as I point out in the introduction to Glittering Images, that they will be about impressionist painters, can automatically bring in, you know, crowds, but rarely, you know, will a contemporary artist be of much interest. I mean, I live in a museum city in Philadelphia, and New York is also a museum city. People who live in such cities tend to be, I think, overly complacent about the status of the arts elsewhere. The problem is the museum experience is not necessarily a positive one. I can remember making a pilgrimage as a tiny small child, before I wasn't even in kindergarten yet, to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York when it was truly scholarly, okay, in its presentation. Everything kind of crowded. Everything was out. You know, all the objects were out, and there was a sense of the power of scholarship, the seriousness of the enterprise. And now that's changed, right? And in order to make a much more user-friendly environment, there's a lot more space for large crowds. They encourage you to put on these, you know, earphones, which completely changes the experience. The explanatory notes are very much reduced. There's a din, a kind of it's turned into a kind of theme park, okay, a feeling. There's a noise level and an inattention, you know, to the actual artworks, okay, because of this rather commercial presentation. This is another thing I'm criticizing. For example, when I went to the Museum of Modern Art to look at Picasso's Les Demoiselles d'Avignon in person, to make sure I was right about those details that I thought I saw in the work all these years, it was very difficult to do that because of the crowds pushing and shoving and coming up in front of the painting and shooting off the camera and then rushing onward and so on. The atmosphere has so changed. There's no respect for the work, no sense of contemplation anymore. And this is exactly what I'm trying to bring back, okay, through Glittering Images.
That's really fascinating, because what you're describing is that a visit to the museum becomes about the visit itself, the experience itself, rather than anything one might take away.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, literally, I was pushed aside. My attempt to look at details, okay, was regarded with indignation by a horde of German tourists. Okay, who were like flash. Okay, they're going to take that home and look at what their digital image, okay, of the painting, and not stand there because certain paintings really need to be seen in person. For example, Van Gogh used so much paint, laid it on so thickly that it took years to dry. In process of restoration, they even found it was still not dry, you know, behind there. So you have to appreciate the almost sculptural quality of the surface of certain paintings, or Jackson Pollock. No way to reproduce a Pollock, okay, in a book. I had to choose a very small painting to try to make it fit. The gigantic tableau of Pollock, you enter a room and you're overwhelmed by this gigantic canvas. You go up close and you see the gorgeous surfaces with like things and sand and grit and stuff in the surface. And these are works of such power and majesty in person. So visits to the museum should be encouraged, but, you know, as in public libraries or even college libraries these days, an atmosphere of silence and reverence, you know, is no longer encouraged.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Gabe who says, my experience with art is that it always tells a story, but the cycle that I notice is that early media is new but not very refined. Later art is very refined and exciting but almost never original. What do you think about that?
Well, when he says that when Gabe says that all art tells a story, I would question that. And there's not always a story. There's a meaning, okay? But there is narrative art, but not all is narrative. Some is like iconic. Okay, and then I'm sorry. What was the second part of his question?
That when later art comes along, it's quite refined and exciting, but not original. So I guess the technique has been and style has been improved and perfected. But
well, there are great moments of originality in the history of the arts. But originality as a value is really only from the Romantic period and of the late 18th century. Artists before that never thought that originality was a goal. Shakespeare, for example, was constantly pirating his sources and combining, you know, stories from some Italian collection with Anglo-Saxon chronicles and so on, in modern times, our cult of originality is actually kind of symptomatic of our own poverty. For example, the audience that went to Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, everyone knew the story. Everyone had seen 10 different theatrical versions of it, and so the appreciation was of the manner of the telling rather than of the content.
Well, yeah. Do you think that originality is something we feel we need more now because our technology allows us to create, you know, perfect facsimiles of whatever we might want to represent?
Well, as I say, this pressure for the artist to be original has become a great burden. It's partly because of the history of the avant-garde, the violent overthrow, you know, of one style by another, and the suffering of those original avant-garde artists like, you know, Courbet and Monet and so on. But where I see the pressure particularly destructive is on young rock musicians, okay, who don't have time to learn their own instruments, don't have time to work with them and to get the virtuosity of the master musician. Instead, they're being forced by the corporate contracts to go out on the road and to constantly do original material and so on. I think that eats up our young artists. Great surviving bands like the Rolling Stones. You see, Keith Richards carries around the world, you know, his African American blues, you know, records, and feeds off the roots of the past, and that sense of continuity with a tradition that went before, I'm afraid, is pretty rare, and that's why even our mass media is getting increasingly thin.
I was really interested to read that you, who are a great champion of the arts, of course, an educator in the arts, argue that self-education is a critical part of anyone's deep engagement with art. Can you talk about what you mean by self-education and why it is so important?
Yes, I think people have a personal responsibility to educate themselves. You cannot just wait passively, servilely, okay, for authority figures to hand you revelation on a platter. Some people will have good luck to have a great teacher. Others will have second-rate teachers or mediocre teachers. But the library is there, and now the library is at your fingertips via the computer, especially in art. You just go to Google Images, and you can find absolutely everything. It's an incredible treasure house of imagery out there. You can learn so much about the world. So, I mean, I think that self-education is a lifetime mission, a lifetime obligation. That's why I so much admire the great doctors of the church, okay, of the Catholic Church, including my heroine Teresa of Avila, okay, you know, these are you can't be waiting around, okay, for someone to teach you. You have to go out. You know, it's like a pattern, okay, that you must embark on. It's like the wave of a pilgrim.
Is there reason to imagine a brighter future ahead for the arts?
Well, every time things fall apart, okay, there's a revival. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've written an essay on this, you know, this dynamic in the history of the arts of revival, and so I think that there's going to be a revival someday, okay. But whether it requires the total destruction of Western culture first, I don't know.
Camille Paglia is University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Her latest book is called Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. Camille, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. We had help on the phone from Christina Martinez. And Lindsay Connect produced today's show with Jeff Whittington as executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at KERA.org/think, and we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.